Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 22. It's May 29th, 2020. Introduction. William Still's landmark, The Underground Railroad, was first published in 1872. Its emotive accounts of runaway black slaves were the product of the turbulent decade of the 1850s as the country tumbled towards civil war and the status of African Americans, free and enslaved, reached its nadir. That war did not break out earlier was the result of a deal brokered between politicians from North and South that seemed to secure the future of slavery. The so-called Compromise of 1850 consisted of a clutch of new laws that sought to meet the challenges posed by the vast territories acquired by the United States at the end of the Mexican-American War of 1846 to 48. At the heart lay the passing of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. This law strengthened the original 1793 Act, which had criminalized those assisting runaway slaves, but had been weakly enforced. The deal benefited the South, enraged Northerners, and undermined the security of the thousands of African Americans living in non-slave states. The new law increased the punishment for those involved. Penalties were to be strictly enforced by federal officers across the Union committed to the recapture of fugitive slaves, even those who had been living in freedom for decades. Unsurprisingly, the law also endangered the lives of freeborn African Americans who, with little or no legal protection, became potential victims of ruthless Southern slave catchers supported by the might of the federal government. Reaction to the law, passed in September 1850, was immediate as anti-slave societies across the northern states asserted their opposition. In Philadelphia, few were more active than William Still. Still was born in New Jersey in 1821, the son of a free black father and a fugitive slave mother who, in her escape from her owner in Maryland, had been forced to abandon two of her four children. The rescue of William's brother Peter from slavery by white abolitionist Seth Conklin, more than 40 years later, forms the centerpiece of the Underground Railroad's first gripping narrative. In 1844, Still left the family farm and moved to Philadelphia, where he taught himself to read and write. By 1847, he was clerk of the city's anti-slavery society, and in 1851, such were his talents that he was appointed chairman of the city's most politicized branch, the Philadelphia Vigilance Committee. It aimed to oppose and subvert the new fugitive slave law by aiding runaways in transit along the Underground Railroad to safe locations in the far north and Canada. The railroad was, in fact, no railroad at all in the literal sense. However, while some historians of the mid-20th century argued that the term had no relevance beyond the realm of legend, it is now accepted that the concept of a railroad was very real for those involved. For William Still and others, the term railroad described a complex series of networks scattered across the states, north and south. This was no cohesive, unified system. Instead, they operated at a local level and were linked by groups and individual agents. Together, they provided interconnected routes along which fugitives were transported via a series of safe houses to freedom. Common railroad terminology of the time was used to describe the various elements. Financial supporters were stockholders. Those who transported escapees were conductors. The escapees themselves were passengers. And they traveled from station to station. These are all terms that resonate throughout Still's narratives. The term Underground Railroad emerged in the 1850s, though its exact origin is unclear. However, it undoubtedly reflected the transport revolution taking place across America as railroad construction boomed, resulting in almost 30,000 miles of track by 1860. The country promoted the technological realization of its manifest destiny to span the continent. In response, African Americans trumpeted their own aspirations for the future in the form of a railroad that led them to freedom. Still's remit was broad. Philadelphia lay at the center of networks that extended along the east as far south as Georgia and as far north as Massachusetts. Throughout the 1850s, the Vigilance Committee supported the needs of hundreds of fugitives, providing medical and financial support and assistance in securing the freedom of family members left behind. It also functioned as a communications hub for the broader African-American community within and without the borders of the United States. Those who passed through Philadelphia were interviewed, and it was Still who recorded their testimonies. Many remained in contact with him once they had reached freedom, soliciting his support and expressing their thanks. The greatest irony, however, was that freedom for most was not to be found in the land of liberty itself. Some settled in the western part of New York State, but as Still's testimonies make clear, the majority opted for the neighboring province of Canada West, today's Ontario. As early as 1793, the Act Against Slavery had been passed in what was then Upper Canada, prohibiting the further importation of slaves and freeing the children of female slaves born after the passage of the Act at the age of 25. In 1834, slavery was banned across the British Empire. The black population of the British colonies continued to battle prejudice and carry out most of the menial tasks, but they could run their own businesses, they had the right to vote, and as British subjects, they received legal protection equal to whites. Many African Americans, therefore, were more than happy to abandon the struggle for U.S. citizenship and embrace that the protection being a British subject offered. Indeed, in the black imagination, the British provinces attained a status of mythic proportions. Crossing the Ohio River from slave to free state might have been the equivalent of crossing the Jordan. It was to the north that Canaan beckoned, and to borrow a term coined by the African Canadian poet Wade Compton, the freeing slave would arrive in an imagined Xanada, a combination of Xanadu and Canada. It was not only fugitives who found succor in Canada. As early as 1829, free blacks in Cincinnati, Ohio, faced with the passing of restrictive anti-black laws, crossed the Detroit River to found the settlement of Wilberforce, named after the leading British abolitionist. Though the settlement was eventually disbanded, other communities such as Dawn and Elgin followed, ensuring that Canada West remained a promised land for them and their fugitive siblings. By 1860, approximately 30,000 African Americans had fled the United States to find protection under the British flag. The letters that Still received from refugees whose escape he had assisted resonate with anguish over the wives, husbands, parents, and children left behind, but they also bear witness to the newfound sense of security enjoyed in British America. Hitherto kept secret, Still's records and correspondence were published in 1872. The Underground Railroad was a massive work of several hundred pages, yet it immediately sold out. Such was the prestige of the archive of African American voices that it was displayed at the Philadelphia Centennial Exhibition in 1876. Two other editions followed in 1878 and 1883, both of which were avidly consumed by a fascinated public. What follows is a new abridged version of the 1878 edition, highlighting the most dramatic and poignant of the fugitive testimonies. Escape in a wooden crate, pursuit by bloodhounds, women disguised as men, and vice versa, the terror of recapture. All are to be found in the accounts which Still entrusted to his diaries over more than a decade. The 1872 preface was written during the high tide of optimism that followed the passage of the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery in the United States, and the radical reconstruction taking place in the defeated South with its promise of a bright future for the nation's newly enfranchised African-American citizens. Still made it clear that publication had been undertaken at the request of the Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society, which asked him to compile and publish his reminiscences and experiences related to the Underground Railroad. For him personally, the work freed the voices of those hitherto silent, raising the possibility of reunion for loved ones separated, whether by the auction block or the enforced flight to freedom, both echoing his own painful family experience. He also sought to commemorate a hard-fought battle, to show what efforts were made and what success was gained for freedom under difficulties. The tone of the preface to this edition, however, is very different. By 1878, Reconstruction was on the wane, leading to the emergence of a segregated society and the adoption of Jim Crow laws across the South, ghettoizing African Americans, cheating them of the vote, relegating them to the status of second-class citizens. When Still reminds us that the antebellum South was the prison house, he seems to be drawing his readers' attention to both dangers overcome and those that lay ahead. Now his aim was to reinvigorate the spirits of his fellow freedmen. I have always cherished that this work would encourage the race in efforts for self-elevation, he wrote. His testimonies have become reminders of a bitter past and aspirations only partially realized. His voices spoke of the struggles of men and women to obtain their freedom, education, and property. And for him, the future no longer seemed certain. In the political struggles, the hopes of the race have been sadly disappointed, he wrote. From this direction, no great advantage is likely to arise very soon. Throughout his life, Still continued to participate in Philadelphia's African-American community. He founded the city's first black YMCA, served as president of the board of managers of the Home for Aged and Infirm Colored Persons, and was known for his unstinting charitable donations. But it was for his work on the Great Railroad that he was remembered. Upon his death in 1902, the New York Times obituary of July 15th noted that Still was known throughout the country as the father of the Underground Railroad. This was a tribute not only to the key role he had played in assisting and supporting fellow African Americans during their darkest hours and placing himself in great danger, but also his testimony to the archival monument that he left to posterity in the form of the Underground Railroad. And it's signed Gareth Hallett Davis, University College London, January 2017. And what follows is a bunch of letters. I've mentioned in prior dispatches, I really love reading letters. I have a list of future topics and sources, and I plan to read 3 or 4 chapters from a book called Three Friends, which are letters written back and forth among three friends here in Austin, notable for being the three gentlemen on Philosopher's Rock in front of Barton Springs, Walter Prescott Webb, J. Frank Dobie, and Roy Bedichek, all UT professors. And I look forward to reading those and many other letters. It's a great, letters are fantastic. One of the projects I hope to launch actually is a letter writing project among the regulars. I think there's still something special about a letter written in longhand, especially, or typewritten, not edited with Grammarly and Google autocorrect and all of that, that you have to compose your thoughts in longhand, and also that it takes a little while for them to arrive. It puts a nice delay in front of the communication to let the settlement settle back into the riverbed and the water to clear. I like that a lot, and I have an idea for getting that in the air. I'm also obviously incredibly struck by this narrative of the introduction here, and the idea of on American ground fleeing to freedom at grave risk and leaving behind family, including your very own children, or some of your children. Heartbreaking in the extreme. Also, just wildly impressed with an individual like William Still, who, as an adult, teaches himself to read and write and becomes such a leader. Also, incredibly inspired by the very idea of the Underground Railroad, a local stitched together patchwork quilt of various roles and responsibilities and risk-taking, all coordinated, all with a shared goal, about as important as it gets. Fascinating and inspiring stuff. Heroic, truly heroic for everyone. And, Independence Day isn't that far away. I hope I'll be reading some of these letters. They're powerful. and other sources. I also like, you know, thus far when delving into history, I began talking about Willie Nelson's first show at the Armadillo. Very fitting. It was Willie's birthday. Eddie Wilson is one of our friends, the proprietor of Threadgills, since he bought the joint from Kenneth back in the day. And that was a great place to start. I think, obviously, it's stating the obvious. History is fascinating, incredibly important, full of lessons. And I think there will be quite a bit more history that makes sense in this, in these dispatches, and will form an important part of the chord, a through line for all of it. And I think next week I may read from a book of history called The Great Plains by Walter Prescott Webb. Again, one of the three from Philosopher's Rock, one of his great works, though it starts with geography. And it's fascinating why, as a historian, he starts with geography, and worth considering. And I think, well, just contemplating letters and history and the importance of recognizing what's gone before and who the heroes are that we all of us stand on the shoulders of and owe great debt to and need to emulate as best we can. Geography is coming soon too. Hope you'll have a great weekend. Thank you for listening. Talk to you soon.